The emissary tells me to step close to the wall, a smooth metallic surface in which there is a round opening. I step forward and a bright green tentacle comes out and waves around, searching for contact. I am frozen in horror. I don't withdraw, partly because I can't react fast enough, and partly because I said he could touch. The tentacle shoots out, wrapping itself under my bundle as I carry it, catching on my clothing. Ugh! The tentacle corrects, wraps around all of us in its tight squeeze, and then retracts quickly. Now I know why the emissary must remain behind the wall. He's a green monster. Now, is this a remarkable dream or what? I mean, it's no wonder that this dream stayed with this woman. So we have here some psychic content that exists in a dying on a dying planet. We have to imagine that this is an impoverished place in her psyche, in the unconscious. But there is this emissary, this green monster, who searches throughout the land to find the remnant pieces of life and to bring them back for transport to Earth. Now, our whole story of The Little Prince is about transport to Earth, so you can see why I was intrigued to include this dream. Barbara and her first analyst worked on that dream for a long time. 10 years later, when she moved to New York and we began our work together, the dream was still alive for her, and so the question about its mysterious meaning. Quote, I suffered that monster and that bear cub lovingly for a long, long time, Barbara said, but I could not get him to Earth in a way that felt real. Somehow that's my job here with you. I didn't know, had no idea what she meant, except I was intuitively connected to the possibilities, you know. And I thought she was probably right, that, but I didn't know what to think about the green monster or how we might help him or her and his vulnerable cargo find a way down to Earth. Now, green. What about green? Well, here's a quote from Robin van Lobenzel's book, A Dream in the World. Robin happens to also be my wife, so I know a lot about the color green because I read this manuscript in various editions. Green, she said, is Aphrodite's color, and older still, the color of Osiris, the dying and reborn god. Green is also the color of Sophia and the Holy Spirit. Did you know that? The color of life, of procreation, also the color of resurrection. Greenness also connotes the benedicta veritas, the blessed greenness, which, according to Jung in Mysterium, signifies the secret immanence of the divine spirit of life in all things. It signifies hope and the future. The blessed greenness, the benedicta veritas, the divine spirit of life in all things. So green is the color of life and the renewal of life in its vegetative form. The green monster then would seem to be centrally concerned with life, especially endangered life. He searches it out and saves it for eventual transfer to Earth, where presumably it needs to go to come alive again. Barbara and I were both touched by the simple fact that the psyche does this, that it holds our soulful innocence until such time as this innocent aliveness is ready for experience. It moved me just to think about it. You know, Winnicott used to say that the true self is put in cold storage for thawing out later. But here we have very beautiful imagery that corresponds to that. Okay, now I'm going to tell you the story of The Little Prince, and I'm sorry I don't have illustrations. I just spent 2 hours trying to figure out how to get imagery from the internet onto PowerPoint, and I couldn't do it. So someday I will figure that out, and you will be able to see, those of you who want to do this again with me, you'll be able to see a full unfolding of the story, because the illustrations that Saint-Exupéry put in his book are just... How many of you know The Little Prince? I can't imagine that... Yeah, good. Okay, so you know the illustrations, the wonderful illustrations. So we have the two worlds in our story, the spiritual world of the divine child, the little prince, royal prince, living on his tiny perfumed planet, tenderly watering his beloved single rose, devotedly cleaning his three tiny volcanoes, and diligently moving his chair 44 times every day so he can enjoy the beauty of multiple sunsets. Remember this? Listening every night to the music and the stars up there, he lives contentedly in his own world. As yet, he doesn't know he's lonely. He has not yet encountered conflict or experienced betrayal in order for his innocence to be transformed slowly into experience. Then there's the world of the so-called grown-ups. They occupy a parallel universe in our story. Some of them live on asteroids also. And they all seem to be embodiments of emptiness and absurdity. Our crashed pilot is one of these grown-ups. He's very grown up, but his life has come to a dead end. He has crashed his plane in the Sahara Desert and is trying to repair his engine. The story tells us that as a child, the pilot had a vivid imagination, just like the little prince, but that he's forgotten. As a child, he would often draw mysterious and remarkable creatures, like boa constrictors with elephants inside them. And he would show these drawings to all the other grown-ups. But the grown-ups around him all thought that these were simply hats. They never understood his drawings, and slowly, sadly, he gave up drawing boa constrictors from the outside and the inside. Instead, he spoke only of golf, bridge, politics, and neckties. Thereafter, the grown-ups found him to be a very sensible person. But something in him was no longer alive, except maybe when he flew his airplane. So the two worlds in our story, the magical world of childhood on the one hand, innocent and full of mystery and imagination, and the grown-up world on the other hand, full of sensible things, albeit meaningless, empty, and boring, these two worlds are separated by cosmic distances. Just like in the individuation process, a major dynamic of our story is the separation between these two worlds and how this separation will be resolved. Each of these two worlds is incomplete without the other. The little prince is quintessentially alive, but is all alone in this aliveness on his own planet, living in a bubble of unknowing naivete. The pilot is going through the motions of life, having become a very sensible worldly man, rushing around doing important things, but soulless and without the animation that would bring his life meaning. If life is to be lived to the fullest, if wholeness is to be realized, then these two separate worlds will have to get together. And this will require a particular kind of conscious suffering, a particular depth of suffering that neither Little Prince nor the crashed pilot has experienced before. Our story tells us that the suffering required in this process has to do with enormous sadness and grief, consciously experienced, because it's going to be the suffering that reconnects to when these worlds were first split and separated. Only this time, it's not going to be the usual suffering, the neurotic suffering that they've been doing, but rather a meaningful suffering where these two worlds come together. This grief and sadness seems to happen particularly when the two worlds come together and meet or are held in tension. In other words, where transitional space is reawakened. Innocence must suffer experience and in this sense be disillusioned. At the same time, the dried-up, ego-dominated world of the pilot must suffer the grief of loss and then what Carol Savitz, a Jungian analyst in New York, calls re-illusionment, which means feeling things that have been repressed or forsaken and allowing life to be reanimated by contact with the other world. Now, in our story, the process of betrayal of innocence happens to the little prince as he begins his journey to Earth from one asteroid to the other, like stepping stones. In the drawings, you see him making his journey sort of pulled along by a flock of birds to which he's tethered from one asteroid to the next. He meets various people, the geographer, all of them are leading absurd existences, measuring things that don't need to be measured, expostulating to no audience truths that don't need to be said. They're all, you know, absurd images of grown-up world. In each case, the little prince says, why are you doing this? And isn't there something more to this life? And he keeps traveling from one asteroid to the next. He next comes to Earth, and true to our original Western myth of consciousness in the Garden of Eden, he meets the snake. He asks the snake, why are there no men in the desert? The snake can see that the little prince is still mostly innocent, having just fallen from a star, and he feels sorry for what lies ahead on this earth of granite. He assures the new arrival that if things get too bad for him, the snake can always get him back to his home planet in no time with just one little bite. The little prince understands perfectly. Here the snake, like Lucifer in the Genesis account, stands for consciousness, but also for unconsciousness through dissociation. When experience gets too much, he can put you in an altered state and remove you back home, just like the defensive agency of the self-care system, just one little bite. So armed with this new knowledge, the little prince continues his journey in search of companions. On a lonely mountain peak, he cries out, let's be friends, I'm lonely, answers the echo. And then the real pain for him begins. He stumbles into a garden of 5,000 roses and is suddenly overcome with another huge disillusionment. His single rose had told him that she was the only flower of her kind in all the world, but she had lied to him. She was just a common rose. The little prince realizes that what he had all along was a miserable common rose together with three motley volcanoes, one of which was even extinct. Betrayed and disillusioned, he suddenly feels like he isn't a very great prince after all, and he lays down in the grass and starts to weep. And at this crucial moment, who should appear but the fox? And the little prince finds his first friend on the earth. The fox in this story is a kind of psychopomp who teaches the little prince how to love, and his lessons are movingly relevant to our work as therapists and our work inside our important relationships. So I want to examine the dialogue carefully here. Come and play with me, the little prince proposes. I'm feeling so sad. I can't play with you, the fox said. I'm not tamed. Oh, excuse me, said the little prince. But upon reflection, he says, well, what does tamed mean? Then the fox, speaking like a modern-day attachment theorist, explains that tame means to establish ties. This confuses the little prince, so the fox explains further. For me, says the fox, you're only a little boy just like 100,000 other little boys, and I have no need of you. And you have no need of me either. To you, I'm just a fox, like 100,000 other foxes. But if you tame me, we will start to need each other.